Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
Welcome once again to Reconstruction, the weekly podcast from the Construction Index, with me, David Taylor, editor of the Construction Index magazine, and Phil Bishop, editor of our daily online news at theconstructionindex.co.uk. It's Thursday, the 4th of March, 2021, and we're recording this week on a Thursday because yesterday Rishi Sunak delivered his second budget, the second budget of his chancellorship, which is far more important than the first one, which of course he had to rip up and bin straight afterwards because of COVID-19. So we're going to talk about the budget, but first of all, welcome Phil, and anything you want to get out of the way before we dive into that?
Well, busy, busy, busy. Of course, the budget is the main topic of the week, and there's plenty to talk about. And as you say, that's why we are a day late. Sorry for anyone who came looking for us yesterday evening and couldn't find us, but we are on Wednesday evening, I should say, but here we are now. Some other news items of interest, I think, have cropped up, which I don't think we need to discuss at length because we've talked about them before. But they're interesting that they confirm some of these trends that we've been talking about that we've spotted. And the first one we could mention is we talked about, do you remember we talked to the managing director of Triton Construction about employee
Yes.
ownership trusts and employee buyouts and so on? And there have been more and more, since we spoke to him, be more and more of these companies moving into employee ownership. The latest being a London utilities contractor called Falco Construction. Not a company I'm familiar with, but I hope they will become increasingly familiar with them. I hope they go on to great things under employee ownership. And I just think it's interesting, you know, as an exit strategy for business owners to avoid capital gains tax, and selling the business to employees. So that's another interesting one. And another another utterly separate trend we've talked about, I suppose it's not entirely separate, another popular way for business owners to exit their business is to sell to vulture capitalists, private equity investors. And one of the big private equity players in the builders merchant market is Cairngorm Capital Partners, and they've been at it again, or rather Grant & Stone, a company they bought in November 2019, have been at it again with three more acquisitions this week. One pretty major from down your neck of the woods, I believe, Royal Gammon & Baker, RGB Holdings, who are a pretty big-sized regional builder's merchant.
And
a couple of smaller ones, Build It and Total Plumbing Supplies. So this is now creating a group. They say they're now the Grant & Stone group, say they're now the largest independent builders merchant group in the south of England, more than 1,000 employees, and combined revenues approaching 250 million. So again, something we talked about, a trend we've identified, and just to confirm that we weren't wrong, which is always nice to be able to say that occasionally.
Yes, indeed. Yes, that's quite interesting. When we talked about rationalisation of the builders merchant sector last time, I think I might have suggested that I thought that RGB, Royal Gammon & Baker, might be on the lookout for acquisitions themselves. Well, I was wrong about that one. but you are quite right to say that there is quite a lot of rationalisation going on in that sector. So interesting feature there.
A totally different story I'd also like to quickly mention. This morning I discovered, it actually came out a couple of days ago, I was a bit slow on the uptake, Ashtead Group, the parent company of what we used to call A-Plant, now Sunbelt Rentals UK. They produced their third quarter trading figures. I never normally look at third quarter figures, but I should have done, and eventually I did look at this. And what was interesting about this is it revealed that since the first national lockdown, the COVID announcement at the end of March, in other words, since April to December last year, Sunbelt Rentals UK got a quarter of its revenue from Department of Health work, setting up COVID testing centres, supplying, you know, Nightingale Hospital, all this sort of stuff. And if fair play, you see the work it's done. I'm sure it's £110 million of work, but it's £110 million Sunbelt Rentals have got in revenue. Their profits haven't gone up much, so maybe they're doing it all at cost. I don't know, but it's big business. And I've often wondered, we've sung the praises of all these companies that have done great work, stepping up to the plate to set up the Nightingale hospitals and so forth. But I've often wondered, no one's actually saying what they're getting paid for it. You know, how much business is there in this? Because it almost seems impolite to ask. That's not relevant now. We're saving lives here. Don't talk about money.
Oh, I'm sure it's not a case of that. They'll have their rates.
Ash should have shown us what they've got. And it's £110 million from the Department for Health, which is big bucks and quite interesting.
That's interesting. It is interesting. And I wonder, I mean, Ashted is obviously a big organisation. There must be many more smaller companies further down the supply chain that have also benefited through this. So, you know, there's a trickle-down effect there.
I assume so. Certainly hope so. To get on to the main business of the week, or did you want to have something else on that?
No, let's get on to it and talk about how much money the government is prepared to throw around with great generosity. It was an interesting budget. I mean, I have to say that, generally speaking, I'm pretty budget phobic. I think it's because I've never been an enthusiastic news hound to quite the extent that you are, but I've always worked on sort of news-oriented publications. And I was always slightly dismayed at the enthusiasm at which people leapt upon each budget every time it came along. People would gather around the television or the radio, taking frantic notes, and then there would be this frenzy of analysis afterwards. Of course, the BBC is the most obvious one, but when you work in a news organisation, you see it firsthand. And I it was always like a national sport. The analysis and the picking apart of the Chancellor's budget speech afterwards. And I always thought it's best to let other people get on with this. But here I am talking about it. And I'm glad to say that I think there are some very interesting aspects to Rishi Sunak's budget this time round, because, of course, it's coming under such unusual circumstances. Last time he delivered, well, the first time he delivered his budget, as I said in my introduction, it was all rendered rather academic shortly afterwards because of the measures he had to bring in to combat the COVID-19 pandemic. This time we're seeing how he intends to actually balance the books and take us through to the recovery phase. And there are some interesting aspects to this, pluses and minuses, but I think probably mainly pluses. What do you think, Phil?
It would be hard to tell the difference between the budget Rishi Sunak delivered and the budget that John McDonnell might have delivered had he been Jeremy Corbyn's Chancellor. Such has been the shift forced upon British politics and economics by the COVID crisis and the economic crisis that it's induced, is that we're all Keynesian now. I've said this before. Having said that, broadly speaking, I think, you know, there will be chickens that come home to roost, and we all comment on budgets far too quickly. But there are, in amongst the slightly scary stuff like, you know, corporation tax going up and how that's going to clobber our pension savings if and when we ever get to retire, there are, you know, long-term ghoulies in there. But I think we knew that. It was inevitable. I don't think there's any dodging that because of the situation we're in. If you're government, you either say to the country, just go hang yourself, we can't be bothered now, or you keep trying and keep trying to run the country. And, you know, they keep trying and they keep trying to run the country. And I think that's the only answer.
I heard Rishi Sunak, when he was making his speech yesterday, he made it quite clear. He said that, the impact of COVID-19 is going to be with us for decades to come. Yeah. He said not just this government, but subsequent governments over decades. It's an interesting situation to be in, to have to announce the way forward and sort of signpost our direction of travel for decades rather than just this next parliament. If we were to boil it down to the big giveaways and the big take-backs, I mean, what the big plus, I suppose, for people in the construction industry and certainly for companies, employers and manufacturers and contractors is this proposal of super deductions.
Yes, I think that's the story. I mean, there are, for parts of the industry, you know, the house builders, of course, the extension of stamp duty land tax holiday is a big thing. The 5% mortgages becoming available for first time buyers. These are big things for the house building sector, but for the wider construction industry, for civil engineering contractors, for the plant hire companies particularly, this super deduction idea, which is a new one on me, is it could be a game changer in persuading everyone to dump now their old tier 3, tier 4 machinery and go, you know, gung-ho tier 5 or hybrid or electric and completely green and clean their machinery fleets.
Because what it does, I mean, if anybody's missed it, I'm sure most of our listeners haven't missed it at all, is that basically you're getting 130% tax deductible allowance on capital investments. So for every £100 you invest, you get £130 worth of tax credits, which is great. It makes me want to rush out and buy loads of office equipment.
Well, as Anna said, to put it in other words, if you spend £1 million on diggers, instead of being able to cut your tax bill by £250,000, you can now the tax payment on £250,000, you can now do it on £1.3 million comes off your profits. I think it's a hugely significant incentive.
Yeah,
and I think that comes in pretty much immediately. Whereas the
I think it does.
The capital gains tax increase doesn't come in until 2023, going up to 25% for those businesses with profits greater than 250,000. If your profits are less than
that's the other side of the coin, isn't it? That's the big blow, really.
But that's delayed. That's pushed back a little bit. Yeah. But the super deduction is temporary. I can't remember how long it's in for. Yeah, it begins April 2021, so next month. But I'm not sure how long it's in for. But it is only temporary. And I think the plant dealer's going to be rubbing their hands in glee.
Yeah, absolutely.
I suppose Ritchie Brothers is going to be rubbing their hands in glee. There's lots of used equipment up for auction being shipped out of place as well.
And there are other things that will be welcomed by a lot of our listeners, I'm sure. I mean, this UK Infrastructure Bank, which is going to be located in Leeds, is going to be basically a vehicle to spend £12 billion of capital investment on infrastructure. I don't know why it's going to be in Leeds. Is this all part of the levelling up agenda, do you think?
Partly that, and partly because Leeds is God's own country and one of the finest cities in the world. But the Infrastructure Bank was not a surprise there. I think we knew it was coming because we've no longer got access to the, you know, EU institutions.
Yes.
But I gather this morning that the money that the Infrastructure Bank's got at its disposal will be significantly less than what we had from the European Union beforehand. Now, maybe it'll ramp up and crank up in due course, but it's not as big as it could be. And I gather Germany's got an infrastructure bank which is considerably larger. So maybe it will grow, but it's interesting. It's nice. It's good that we've got it. I wasn't hugely blown away by that, because I think we knew it was coming. Similarly, there was another a little sort of announcement tucked away. Rishi didn't mention it in his speech, but if you dig through the red book that the Treasury publishes to accompany the budget, he's put aside, was it £10 million or £12 million for a task force within the £10 million seed funding within the Ministry of Housing for an MMC task force to promote the take-up of modern methods of construction.
One of your favourite topics.
It's only the word I hate. I have no problem with building off-site. But this is going to go to operate out of Wolverhampton. Now, it strikes me, I think they must already be spending at least £10 million on promoting these things. I mean, through Homes England and various other bits of the Ministry of Housing, they're doing loads on MMC, off-site construction, modular building, all these sort of things. So I'm not quite sure that £10 million is hugely significant either. I think it's just another, you know, this year's funding, another step in the direction. Similarly, the money announced for road building, rail infrastructure, and all of that. I don't think there's anything hugely interesting there.
I think there were some quite interesting things said about recruitment and training weren't there. I think apprenticeship grants are going to be effectively doubled, I believe. I don't know what they are at the moment. I think they're going up to £3,000. I don't know.
Do you know, I confess I slightly glossed over that, because haven't people stopped taking on apprentices in the past few months? It's all been a bit grim in that department.
Well, presumably that's why they're doing this now. I mean, it was something which I my ears pricked up when I heard him mention it. There's been some talk as well about an incentive to attract skilled people from overseas to the UK, because we obviously need their skills. And that's been a big issue for the construction industry for a long time. Of course, a lot of people were very worried, because with Brexit and the restrictions on the travel within the EU and between the EU and the UK, a lot of employers have been very worried that they're not going to be able to attract the sort of skills that they need when they need them. But I think that there's some incentive. Rishi was talking about working with his colleague, the Home Secretary, to put something in place to attract skills to this country, which is, I suppose, a good thing.
Yes, but again, I'm not quite sure how particularly new. It's something they've been talking about since even before Brexit, the whole, you know, the new immigration rules and the point system and...
Yeah.
How well, you know, we're not going to stop Messi playing for Man United just because of Brexit or whatever. You know, we still want the best people to come here if we can get them. But the problem is, it's not just the best people we need ordinary people as well, I think, or at least with freedom to get them.
Yes, precisely. There was, if you remember, the last budget, the one thing which did provoke quite a lot of debate, and we certainly talked about it on the podcast, was this proposal to phase out the availability of red diesel.
Aha!
I think by 2022, by next year.
Yes, I was going to bring that up.
Don't see anything about that this year.
Well, not in the speech, but they have published, again, in all the paperwork accompanying the budget statement, the results of the consultation. They announced it, as you say, they announced it in the Budget 2020, a year ago, that red diesel is being phased out for all except agriculture and rail vehicle usage from April 2022. Initially, it was going to be from April 2021, but they gave a year's grace on it. And yes, Rishi didn't mention it in his speech at all. But they've now published the results of the consultation that they carried out after that. So I have news for this on this topic.
Oh, good.
They've given further exemptions to the red diesel ban. It's not just...
I think I know what you're going to say.
Not just agriculture and rail vehicles now.
Mm-hmm.
It's also going to be... the exemption is going to be extended to travelling funfairs and circuses. Yay!
Yes. And boats.
And fishing and water freight. So, yes.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Yes. Well, that'll cheer us all up, won't it? We can go to the circus anyway. But no mention of construction equipment anything like that.
But more interestingly, there was an issue, or there were questions about when the red diesel ban comes in. Sorry, it's not a ban. It's the rebate ends. Red diesel, lest anyone forgets, is exactly the same as white diesel, except it's got a dye in it to indicate that it pays less tax, or less tax is paid on it for it. But that you won't be allowed to buy red diesel after the 1st of April 2022. And people who have lots of machinery that uses red diesel says, well, you know, what we've got these big tanks full of the stuff. Will we still be, you know, we understand we can't buy it after April 2022, but will we still be able to use what we've got? And there was discussion about this, and the Treasury have come down and said, no, not only are you not allowed to use it, we expect that before 1st of April 2022, you've got to flush out and wash out your tanks so that when our inspectors come round and your diesel looks a bit red, you can't say, oh, no, that's just a bit left over from before. This is all white diesel, really. You've got to have proper clean tanks. You don't have to flush out your machines. If your digger's still got half a tank of red dyed diesel in there, you can put white on top of it. That's okay. But you can't put any new red diesel into the tanks of your machines either.
So what are they going to do with the stuff sitting in their tanks?
You got to use it. You got to plan. If you know that you've got stocks to last you 6 months, well, 6 months before April 2022, you don't buy any more red diesel. You run it down.
Wow.
And I had a mate at university who was trying to sell his little old Fiat 125 for months and months and months, and was refused to sell it with more than £1.50's worth of petrol in the car, because I think he's only selling it for 25 quid or something. And so he would only ever put a quid's worth of petrol in it. We spent more time pushing that bloody car than driving it.
Yeah. Try and do that with an excavator. So
I think there might be some of that. People say, oh, we can't put too much diesel in. So careful how you go out there, folks.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's hope people don't tip it down the drain. That would be a disaster, wouldn't
it? That would, yes.
There are other things which I thought that might be mentioned that I didn't really notice. I mean, getting back to my comments about the feeding frenzy, which always follows a budget announcement, I got about 20 or more press releases which came flowing through my email portal yesterday after lunch.
Well, I got a lot before lunch, before he'd even stood up to speak. Oh, we welcome the Chancellor's saying that. They just sort of thought, well, whatever it said in the papers or the BBC saying, that must be true, we'll just react to that.
Yeah, I saved, I think, about 13 of them. I'm not going to go through them all, but everybody has something to say about it.
Well, I've posted a lot of them on the website.
Yeah, yeah. Some of the more insightful ones, I have to say, because there were some people who I think were sending out announcements simply in order to remind us that they were there, and they didn't really have an awful lot to say about it. But things like, for example, we talked about this a lot, the IR35 changes in taxation regimes. Nothing was said about that, although somebody stuck their head above the parapet and said that he thought that Rishi Sunak should have announced that they were scrapping the introduction or the rolling out of IR35 to more people, which is due to happen next month. Well, of course, there's no way they were going to do that. That's going to happen anyway.
Well, the other thing that didn't happen, of course, which certainly the Federation of Master Builders, but many other people have been lobbying for, was the reduction in VAT on domestic home improvement work.
Yeah.
We talked about this.
Well, that's a big one.
A couple of weeks ago. Yes. But that, yeah, a long game, that one. That would have been stunning if he'd announced that.
Yeah. And I think I said this last time we discussed it. I cannot see why they don't reduce or remove VAT for RMI projects, domestic RMI projects. I just can't see the argument for keeping it, except, of course, that it is a source of revenue for the government.
What other argument do you need?
Well, yes, true. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, well, I mean, seeing as Rishi Sunak seems to be very good at giving money away, I notice also that the self-employment exemption, what's the
It's a grant. It's just a grant for self-employed people.
Yes, the grant. That's been renewed. So has the furlough scheme. That rather surprised me, actually. The furlough scheme, not so much, but I would have thought that the self-employment scheme would have been... I wasn't expecting another phase of it to be brought in, but that started, I think, yesterday or today.
Another highlight we haven't mentioned yet is the whole question of freeports, which is another thing that's been flagged up, but it's finally named the various locations were lobbying for this. And I would think of freeports as being by the sea, at the coast, and seven of the eight are, but one of them's at East Midlands Airport.
East Midlands Airport,
Which I say, no reason.
Well,
why
I suppose it still is an airport. Yeah. It's
no,
a port.
Absolutely, it's got an air side, a duty free side, and a land side. But the other seven ones are dotted around in the major ports of England. Mm-hmm. The UK government is talking to the Welsh and Scottish devolved governments about having freeports in Wales and Scotland, but that's still work in progress, but that's a plan as well. They'll get them. Mm. And Northern Ireland as well, I should say. I've got mixed feelings about freeports. I mean, I'm familiar with Jebel Ali in the UAE, where all the big construction machinery dealers bring in their equipment for the Middle East and ship it out again, and the idea is that you can import into a freeport, bring stuff in, do stuff to it, add value, export it again without paying UK duty.
Well, you've just preempted one of my questions, which was, what is a free port? I mean, I think I've heard the phrase before. I never really considered what it meant.
That's it. That anyone doing any sort of manufacturing or assembly in a free port, mm-hmm. or value-added process will only pay tax on what they're doing once they move it outside the free port, into the UK, into the
Right,
okay. Normal taxi area of the UK. So it becomes a hub of trading activity. And as I say, if you ever go to these places in the Middle East and Singapore and so on, where you see this masses of activity going on, hive activity, it works really well.
Mm.
And it's coming with all kinds of construction-related goodies, that anything you build, the fee port, within the fee port zones, there'll be a 10% rate on structures and buildings allowance for constructing mm-hmm. or renovating non-residential structures and buildings. I can't imagine there'd be many residential buildings in a fee port. And enhanced capital allowance of 100% for companies investing in plant and machinery for use in fee ports. No stamp duty, no business rates until 30th of September 2026. And I imagine it'll be extended there on afterwards. There's no point. I wouldn't have thought there's much point setting up the whole infrastructure for a fee port only to close it down in 5 years' time. But this is the regime that's been set up for the next 5 years. And a lot of people are very excited by it. I get it. I think it could be a big game changer. I have slight concerns about the potential for dodgy dealings in fee ports.
Really?
It's all a bit like the whole non-DOMS issue, non-domiciled, you know, yes. tax status. It's special perks that people find special ways of bending the rules to suit their purposes, and people will game the system, will get clever.
Well, so there'll be like little tax havens dotted around the coast,
yeah,
and
yeah. and I think we can expect to see, and this is not the reason, no reason for not doing anything, but watch out for those Guardian and Private Eye and Panorama headlines over the, you know, in 5 years' time about abusive free ports and funny things going on in free ports.
Right, okay.
I think they'll be economically great, but politically there might be some future skeletons.
Hmm. You said that you couldn't see any point in setting up a free port and then dismantling it 5 years down the line, which, of course, I can see the logic in that. But surely its status as a free port could be modified or withdrawn at some point.
Yes.
I mean, if you've given people incentive to build infrastructure in these locations, I don't know. I mean, I never really thought about what a free port really is. But when I read this, I thought that, well, maybe that's just a way of stimulating investment into an area, which then perhaps will build a momentum of its own and will carry on and help to regenerate a particular part of the country. I mean, I'm not sure that the East Midlands is that depressed that it needs regenerating at the moment. But
when Margaret Thatcher gave all those incentives and all those goodies to Nissan, for example, to build to invest in the northeast, or to Toyota in Derby, and all these other big inward investments that came in, if they'd thought for a moment that a year later they're going to lose everything, they wouldn't have done it. There has to be some reassurance that we're here for the long haul. This is a long game.
So I wonder what sort of businesses are likely to relocate or to set up business in one of these free ports. You mentioned manufacturing. Does it cover the service sector as well? Is it? You can't ship an awful lot of stuff out of East Midlands Airport on an aeroplane.
We're talking about physical goods, I'm sure. I'm not an expert. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there are service sector companies that will directly benefit rather than indirectly benefit. Mm-hmm. But the as I say, the free ports that I've visited are full of overhead cranes moving containers around, lots of construction machinery parked up, lots of cars waiting to be sold, moved around. It's capital goods, expensive stuff. I suppose the only other thing I've got to say about the budget is, like all budgets, we'll only know how good it was or bad it was in about 5 or 10 years' time. It's always too soon to make judgments. So let's talk about it in 10 years' time, David, when we meet again.
Yeah. Okay, then. Fine. I'll put that in the diary. Well, let's move on to another topic, which is a piece of news, a snippet of news, which cropped up this week quite unexpectedly. I certainly wasn't expecting it, and I thought it was very good news. And that was the fact that Interserve, which is one of our biggest construction firms, and a company which we have previously discussed in terms of the way it has positioned itself in the market. And we, I mean, you and I think both felt that it had been travelling in the wrong direction. It's a company which has had some pretty torrid times recently. Interserve is renaming itself, which normally I would say was just window dressing, but I think this is more significant, don't you?
Well, it's the opposite of window dressing. It's taking the window dressing out and going back to it, going back to its roots. It's changing its name to, Interserve Construction and Interserve Engineering Services are becoming, or have become, Tilbury Douglas Construction and Tilbury Douglas Engineering. The significance of this is that Tilbury Douglas is what it was called before it changed its name to Interserve in 2001.
Yeah.
It actually wasn't. I mean, Tilbury Douglas is sort of a name with deep heritage, but that name only existed for 10 years. In 1991, Tilbury merged with RM Douglas to create a larger construction company, Tilbury and Douglas. Tilbury goes back to Victorian times, escorting barges and dredgers in the River Thames, Tilbury Lighteridge Company. RM Douglas, a Midlands civil engineering contractor. The RMD bit became RMD Quickform, which is also part of Interserve. And as we've talked about here, the Interserve name came along as Tilbury Douglas moved from being specifically focused on construction to being increasingly focused on facilities management, support services, cleaning, hospital cleaning, school foods, all sorts of diverse public sector outsourcing things, largely on the back, at least initially, of PFI, Private Finance Initiative projects, where you undertake to build a hospital and operate it, look after it for 25 years. So you build a school and look after the building for 25 years. And looking after doesn't just mean changing the light bulbs. It means emptying the bins and answering the phones and feeding the children / patients in many cases. They all vary, these contracts. But as a result, what was a construction company got into all sorts of things. And it's exactly the same journey that Carillion took. Carillion had been Tarmac, changed its name, dived into support services, came unstuck a couple of years ago. Remind me, when did Carillion go under?
2018,
January 2018, 3 years ago now. Gosh, time flies.
Yeah.
And Interserve and Carillion have got so many parallels, not least that they both began on this journey by buying part of the government's property services agency, which is a government agency which, as its name suggests, looked after properties, government properties. And it was chopped up into various different bits, and all sorts of people bought different bits. And this got both Tilbury Douglas and Tarmac into this whole universe, which they dived headlong into, loved it. And then the whole FM market crashed after the Osborne, Cameron austerity years. The national minimum wage kept going up. A lot of minimum wage employees in these sort of works. So their liabilities were unaffected, but their revenue stream started to dry up. And so it wasn't just Interserve and Carillion that started to struggle. That's my dog saying hello. Hello, Jeff. Jeff, that's the old dog. Hello, Henry.
You won't thank you for that.
So Carillion went under. Interserve, a lot of observers thought that it was clearly in danger. A lot of observers, commentators, thought that Interserve was going to be next. It was just rescued.
It nearly was.
It was saved. Yeah. It did go into administration. It was put into administration in a pre-pact with the agreement of its shareholders, who didn't get much back, but they got a little bit because the choice was getting absolutely nothing, like Carillion shareholders. So Interserve shareholders got, I think they got a little bit back. I can't remember how many peanuts they got. But the lending banks in this PPAC arrangement bought it out of administration, owning the company. So Interserve is now owned by its banks. Now, they don't want it for the long term. They want shot of it. They've sold the facilities management bit to Mitie, and the construction bit is now what's left. And to be honest, who wants to buy a construction company called Interserve? It's a tarnished brand.
Yeah.
Tilbury Douglas, great brand. Tilbury might, or Douglas even, one of those two, might have been an even better brand. Who knows? But Tilbury Douglas, great brand. And suddenly the banks have got, the owners of the company have got a much higher value, in my view, higher value asset to sell when it comes to I don't know how they're going to get rid of it. Maybe they'll do an employee ownership transfer. I doubt it, but
that'd be interesting. I thought, actually, first of all, I thought that was a really good idea. I think they did exactly the right thing, because Tilbury Douglas, all right, then there's a whole generation of people in the industry who don't know who Tilbury Douglas are. But as you say, it's got some history, and it's got some resonance. It is a construction business. And so I think by calling themselves Tilbury Douglas again, they are clearly positioning themselves and saying what they're about and what they're going to do. I think it's quite a brave decision, because I'm sure there'll be plenty of people out there saying that it was a retrograde step to go back to calling yourself what you were 20 years ago. But they could have paid some sort of image consultant to come up with a completely new name. I remember there was quite a lot of ridicule when Tarmac became Carillion, because people were saying, what does Carillion mean? Doesn't mean anything. They could have dreamt up a brand new name which sounded a bit construction-y and relaunched themselves that way.
That would be madness, because that would have been worth even less than Interserve had been. They then have to spend years building up brand value, or the value built into the new brand. They have in their hands this Tilbury Douglas brand, and I'm delighted to say it doesn't look like they spent more than threepence halfpenny on the logo. It's perfectly,
it's a smart logo.
Simple, strong, nothing wrong with it at all. But they haven't overthought it. It's just a red triangle with some lines in it. It's perfectly strong. Not too complicated or Ponzi. And I think I agree with you that going back to the Tilbury and or Douglas name is absolutely the right thing to do.
Who else could do that? I can't think of many other companies that have morphed into something unexpected and then have gone back. One thing which I did notice, actually, Phil, a story that you posted a while ago. Did we discuss it on the podcast? Wolseley, the plumbing supplies company.
Yes.
Which has been absorbed by its American subsidiary, in effect.
Which is sort of an A-plant story, isn't it?
Yes, very much like that. But I hadn't realised that Wolseley, the plumbing supplies organisation, was once the same Wolseley that made cars.
Yes, I read that too.
Isn't that astonishing?
Only for about...
That was a real surprise.
Not for very long at all. If you go back, you think that was really interesting. But actually, the Wolseley car maker that became the plumbing bit, I'm not even sure they even owned it. I don't think the plumbing bit even owned... I think they started off making bicycles, and they had a powered bicycle or some sort of scooter or something on the way to a car. And it was only, I don't know, a couple of years or something that they were involved, that Wolseley was involved in cars. But the name comes from there. The heritage comes from
there. Yes, I think the car business was bought out by Morris, was it? Probably Morris. And then, of course, that all became...
Well, Leyland eventually, wasn't it?
Yeah, British Leyland and Rover, yes. So, that was quite a revelation tucked away at the bottom of a story.
I mean, one of the strongest brands in British construction is Taylor Woodrow. I mean, we have Taylor Wimpey, the house builder. It's the merger of Taylor Woodrow and George Wimpey's housing business. But Taylor Woodrow, which is what was previously behind Taylor Wimpey, if you know what I mean, it was bought by Vinci a number of years ago. And I'm always surprised when occasionally Taylor Woodrow crops up as a Vinci brand. It's French-owned, it's part of Vinci. Vinci's a huge corporation. And they will occasionally use the Taylor Woodrow name. They think, it's nice to see that name again. Hello, Taylor Woodrow. Yeah. Missed you.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, you're right. It surfaces from time to time, but it doesn't seem to have a sort of a...
It's not front and centre, which I think Vinci should do. I mean, if I was Vinci, I wouldn't use that name, or Vinci, if you want to get Roman about it.
Well, I didn't know that of Vinci, because they're French.
Oh, I immediately go back to Veni, Vini, Vinci.
Yeah. Well, it might have been that. I don't know where the name comes from. I mean, we talk about Leonardo da Vinci, and that's why we call it Vinci. But it's a French firm, not an Italian firm. No, I have it on good authority that everybody in the UK calls a company Vinci, so I think we're on fairly solid ground there.
But if Vinci did change their UK construction front big leading name to Taylor Woodrow, because they thought it had huge resonance and value, I and every other journalist would be on the phone saying, you're selling off your UK interests, are you? Because that's always your first reaction. If you sort of hive something under a new brand, it's your you're semi-divorcing yourself from it.
Something very similar happened with the UK's, possibly the world's, foremost scaffolding organisation as well, SGB.
SGB, yes.
Scaffolding Great Britain. A huge company in the sector, I mean, totally dominating the scaffolding sector, making it, basically invented modern scaffolding and also as a contractor. And they were bought out by an American company, Brand Energy. I can't remember if they're still called Brand Energy. They were called something else in the interim, and then they resurfaced as Brand Energy.
Were they American or Australian? Isn't there an Australian aspect to this somewhere? Or am I imagining that?
I'm not sure about that.
I'm imagining it.
Yeah. But I think the SGB brand is still around there somewhere because it was so recognisable and it had so much intrinsic value in the industry. I mean, SGB wasn't just a British company. They were scaffolding things all over the world. But then they were bought by, was it Harsco?
That rings a bell.
Yeah, I think it was Harsco. And they rebranded it and then SGB disappeared. And then they came back as Brand Energy, but using the SGB name. I can't remember. But to be perfectly honest, I don't really hear much from them these days. I don't know what they're up to, but they must still be there. But there's another brand which is, as I say, got a lot of intrinsic value in it, and yet it seems underutilized. So I don't know why they're not really pushing the SGB brand again.
Have we run out of steam again this week, David?
I have, I'm afraid. Yeah,
we've covered some ground. What should we talk about next week? What do you think is going to be in the news next week?
Magazine goes to press next week.
Well, I'll tell you what, why don't next week you tell everyone what's going to be in the March issue, or is in the March issue of the Construction Index magazine. Okay. I'm looking forward to hearing about that myself.
Yeah, okay, yeah, let's do that.
I think I've still got some writing to do for you, haven't I? I better get on with that.
You have, yes, I want news.
Right.
Okay.
Well, thank you everyone for listening to another issue, another episode of Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. Do get in touch with us, podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk. Tell us how wrong we are, how right we are, and what you'd like us to talk about and what we should be thinking. Do subscribe. Leave a review, why not? When any of these places like Apple Pod Stores where you can leave a review for podcasts, tell people. We're assuming that if you're still listening at this stage, you quite like it. If you hate it, ignore the last thing I just said. Anyway, we'll be back with you same time next week. From David and I, cheerio.
All the best. Bye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.